my vineyard, which is before me, earns for Solomon 1,000, and I keep 200 as my fruit. There we have Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 12, of the Ward Green translation from 2003, Little Children, our scripture for today. And we see from that that 1,000 is given to Solomon, as we saw also in verse 11, but in verse 12 it mentions that the one who is operating the vineyard is keeping 200, so 20%, or maybe less than 20 if you take the 200 as a fraction of 1,200, be more like 15% or something. So it shows that an agent or someone who is not the owner, but who acts in behalf, earns something like 15%, or some number, which if you just take 2 divided by 10, it's 20%. But if Solomon gets 1,000 and the operator gets, or the agent gets 200, then it's interesting to see it's exactly 20%, which is exactly what agents, that's the maximum that agents get today, even if they represent for example somebody in the entertainment industry. The agent gets 20%, or that's the maximum, 20%, just like we see here, the maximum that could be calculated here. But it's curious too, because what is it saying? Who is the person who is getting the 200? Are they the one working the vineyard? If they're the one working the vineyard, the man who guards the vineyard gives for its fruit as a reward. So he's just the guard of the vineyard. Looks like he's not the one who actually works the vineyard, because he would get more than the owner, you would think. Or, the owner would be more like the agent in that case. Anyway, it's food for thought, and it shows that the Bible is the source of a great number of things that we see ruling or being used in our modern culture as rules for how things are done. So Abraham's oak, we have a picture at the beginning of our article, chapter 4, paragraph 3, the Ark of Urartu, and this oak tree. Let's make it the right size here. There it is. It's a drawing of some kind of Abraham's oak tree. And it shows the very large branches and the enormous trunk of the tree, because it was a very old tree, of course. And people have actually dated that tree. That's one of the oldest trees in the world. It's a real tree. That's more evidence for the Bible's truthfulness too, is the fact that the places like this tree where Abraham lived is real. And so let's read on, shall we, in our study. The radiocarbon date for Noah's Ark, we said, is 3751 BCE and reflects the age of the wood and not the ark itself. It's just 37. Who said 3750? Was it Ron Wyatt who said 3750? Now I can't remember. Let's see. Let's try 3750 and see if that number pops up. I typed 40 instead of 50. Okay. Well, there it is. Oh, we did it by taking 5,700 years before present. There it is. And we got 3751. By subtracting 1950, which is the date given in our common era for the what's called the present. It's even though it's not changing over time, it's 1950 that's considered present. So subtract 5,700 and subtract 1 because there's no year 0, and we get 3751. That's where that came from. So search for the other occurrence of it. Right. And it reflects the age of the wood, not the arc. A subtle but crucial distinction between the actual building of the ark and an earlier time when the tree was cut down. Radiocarbon dating is not as reliable as recorded history. Oh, this is important. I'll talk afterward about my adventures today with the new battery, the car battery, but I've got a lot on my mind to say about that, but I'd like to get the study done first. I've prepared the study, and it's fairly straightforward, but it's very insightful also. It's important to get through this, I think, if we want to understand the time of Noah and the time before that. Radiocarbon dating is not as reliable as recorded history. That's a fact. Which now, by the genealogy, is 4750 years old, if we take 2741 BCE as the first time of recorded history when Nimrod began to rule. That's what we determined in this article. It is about the time of the first dynasty in Egypt that the last, in other words, earliest, historical date of any real certainty has been established. That was the pioneer of radiocarbon, W.F. Libby, who said that in his article Radiocarbon Dating, published in the journal American Scientist in January of 1956, page 107. Libby was, as I said, the one who pioneered the discovery of carbon-14, or radiocarbon as it's called, dating. The half-life of carbon-14 is 5730 years, and dates depend upon knowing how much carbon-14 is present initially. Now, that's actually, we should make sure that we say that that link is actually broken. We don't expect the links to be still valid, but this was a valid link at one time, for sure. But I checked everything. But the thing is, I made a reference to Sir Walter Raleigh, right? And then I went through and I looked it up. Come on now. Is he not here? Oh, I don't refer to Sir Walter Raleigh in this article. Okay. Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, you can find that article in American Scientist almost certainly, but I looked up another reference to something that Sir Walter Raleigh said. It was in one of my other articles when I referred to this book by Sir Walter Raleigh, and I thought that I'd misquoted. I'm sure I wrote this down. I'm going to check right now. I wrote down an error here. Oh, part two. It's in part two, yeah. In part two of this article. It's not part one. Part two. I mentioned Sir Walter Raleigh, and I mentioned that it's volume two. And when I looked it up, I thought it was volume one, but there are actually two volumes in the same book. Two volumes. So it is volume two if you find where volume one ends and volume two starts. So all my work that I did, my research was very thorough, and you won't find any errors, essentially, other than the ones I find myself. There won't be any errors because I did extremely thorough confirmation of everything. And just because the links are broken, that means nothing, because we'll see as we go further on, the faithful organizations do not break the links. But the half-life of carbon-14 is 5730. That's not accurate. We don't really, we don't know. Nobody really knows what the half-life of carbon-14 is. If we're honest, that's just a guess, right? It might be a good guess, but it's just a guess. And dates depend upon knowing how much carbon-14 is present initially. Plus, we then have to know we also have to know how long it's been, or what the half-life is, right, of carbon-14. Then we can determine how much time has passed. If we know how much was present initially, we know the half-life, and we measure how much is left, making an assumption that none is removed or added in any other way, and that's another big assumption. The pioneer of carbon-14 dating, Willard Libby himself, did not place his faith in dates earlier than written history, and he wrote, "These numbers are not known accurately," meaning the radiocarbon is not known. You cannot date things without written history, is what he said. We can only go back as far as written history so that we can confirm the radiocarbon with the written history and calculate and compare the numbers. Radiocarbon dates are always calibrated by another method. The purpose of our article is to impart faith, not method. Without history, you wouldn't know, where the sample originated, whether it was from, whether it had been buried in the ground from a much later date, and or whether you just don't know anything if you don't have any history for the sample. The purpose of our article is to impart faith, not method. Another method is tree ring dating, or dendrochronology, a method for dating wood samples which display growth rings. Such rings indicating variations in growth rates of trees, right? One ring of a tree. Every year, one ring means the number of rings equals the number of years. But the problem with using tree rings to date wood is that the rings produced for wood depend upon temperature and rainfall fluctuations, which are not equatable to one ring per year. Quoting another source, which might be broken also, probably is broken. No, it's not broken. Look at that. There it is. Okay. Trees would appear too old if they grew more than one ring per year. Most dendrochronologists, drawing on an influential study by LaMarche and Harlan, believe that bristlecone pines do indeed add only one ring per year. Yet not all scientists accept this study. According to Harold Gladwin, 1978, the other quote was from 1973, the growth patterns of the bristlecone trees are too erratic for dating. Lammerts in 1983 found extra rings after studying the development of bristlecone saplings. He suggested that the existing chronology should be compressed from 7100 to 5600 years. That's a lot of extra rings that were put into those trees, is what he believed, and that's why he thought the chronology should be shortened based on the trees. The chronology derived from the trees should be shortened. This picture is of an ancient rivet found at the Ark site, which is remarkable, I think we would have to say. Truly remarkable that there was a rivet there on Noah's Ark. In the petrified wood, there was this rivet found right on the Ark itself. Contains high-tech metal alloy. Let's look at that. That link is not broken. I clicked on it. This is what I got. Man-made metal in Ark formation. It shows the Ark rivet had iron, aluminum, and titanium in it in these percentages. 8%, 8%, and 1.5%, respectively, showing that this was obviously man-made, but also it was highly advanced because titanium and aluminum were only made in modern times by humans, except for prior to the deluge, which isn't at all disagreeing with all the ancient civilizations and their amazing technology. When you look at, I've just been watching some of these videos on the YouTube channel. What's it called now? Let's see if I can find it. Megastructures. Yeah, that's the one. Megastructures. It's called Universe Inside You YouTube channel. They have what appears to be many, many videos on that website, on that YouTube channel, showing the ancient technologies that existed before the civilizations that we know about after the flood, like the Egyptians. Long before those civilizations, there were more advanced civilizations, far more advanced. I mean, even though Tutankhamun may have had an iron dagger, a blade with an iron composition, that iron was obtained from a meteorite, we believe. But even though Tutankhamun in 1300 and something BC had the iron in his dagger, there was no iron until roughly some 100 or more years after Tutankhamun, generally. So this the idea that they could cut stone, and that's impossible with bronze, or it's just ridiculous, the way that they cut the stone, and they polished it to a mirror finish. Stone cut perfectly square on the inside of giant megaton caskets, and you could see the reflection of the person in the stone. It was so polished and perfectly square. How can you do that with... You can't even do that nowadays with modern tools. Barely. It would take a long time, certainly. But these were ancient civilizations that made these things, long before even the deluge. So it's not so surprising that there's a rivet here with modern metals in it. Not when you look at those other facts that are available. And even think places like Machu Picchu or ancient places in Japan, they're all over the world, where the construction has been so phenomenally high tech that it's beyond anything even that we can do today, way beyond what we can do today. The petrified wood of Noah's Ark displayed no growth rings at all, because consistent with the written record of the Bible, it comes from trees grown before the deluge when no rain had ever fallen, Genesis 2 and 5. And vegetation received its water from mist coming up from the ground, Genesis 2 and 6. Proverbs 3 and 20, by Jehovah's knowledge, the watery deeps were split apart, and the cloudy skies keep dripping down light rain, or mist, as some translations have it. The dew, in some translations. But Genesis 2 and 6, 2 and 5, Genesis, I have not read this just now. There was no bush because Jehovah God had not made it rain, in verse 5, but a mist would go up from the earth, in verse 6. There were, one translation of that is also that there were underground streams. That's another translation of that, as we'll see here. The Latin Vulgate and Syriac Peshitta versions of the Holy Bible put the word fountain instead of mist, according to the New World Translation in the footnote. Suggestion is added of an underground freshwater stream. Hushai told Absalom of David, "We ourselves shall be upon him as the dew falls to the ground," talking about their scheming against King David. And that, this was from 2 Samuel 17:12. Another quote from Job, "Look, God is more exalted than we can know." Job 36:26-9. "My root is open for the waters, and dew itself will stay overnight upon my bough. My glory is fresh." Job 29, verses 19 and 20. There were waters above the expanse of the heavens from an early time before Jehovah created trees. Genesis 1 and 7. Then God proceeded to make the expanse and to make a division between the waters that should be beneath the expanse and the waters that should be above the expanse. And God began to call the expanse heaven. In the English Standard Version of the Bible, the word for expanse in Genesis 1, 6, 7, 8, 14, 15, 17, and 20 is in the footnote to 1:6, rendered alternatively canopy, the word expanse. The lack of tree rings in the wood of Noah's Ark evidently is consistent with a greenhouse effect caused by the water in the atmosphere, believed to create such uniform climate conditions before the deluge in some places as prevented a growth of tree rings, and whose dispersive effects against the sun's harmful rays may have increased human longevity. In other words, it might be the reason why Adam lived so long and why all of the antediluvian patriarchs, the ones who lived prior to the deluge, that is, lived so long. They were protected by this water canopy. That's just a possibility. But we know that the Bible's consistent with that idea. And the ark would have had tree rings if they'd been there. The petrification would still have preserved the rings if they'd been there. A warmer climate may have contributed to the growth of the reptiles known as the dinosaurs, whose footprints are seen together with human footprints in fossilized mud samples. Yeah, people don't know this, but the footprints of dinosaurs are seen together with footprints of humans in fossilized mud. And the museums find that inconvenient, so they don't, because that would go against the conventional wisdom, so they don't show that, even if they have samples like that. And whose large size is then accounted for, the dinosaur's large size, is then accounted for by longer life, some reptiles being said to grow bigger up until they die. If that's true, right, if reptiles keep growing bigger, if some of them do, which is what is said about some reptiles, they keep getting bigger until they die. Well, that explains why some of the dinosaurs are so large, or were large in the past. The Creation Wiki article, Canopy Theory, mentions that the increased atmospheric pressure associated with atmospheric water vapor atmospheric water vapor can have a beneficial effect on human health. As we have seen, Nimrod ruled in 2774 BCE, whereas his was the fourth generation after Noah. Well, yeah, his rule commenced after the Babel. Really, the world, you know, governments started after the Tower of Babel failed. Before that, they were all together in one group. But in a sense, he ruled in 2774. In one sense, maybe, if he was leading that group who were building the tower. Whereas his was the fourth generation after Noah, according to Mr. Cornazzi, in faith corroborated by three other independent lineages. The biblical line of Shem tells that an average generation is about 130 years for the first few generations after the deluge. Right? That's from the Septuagint. It's not 30 years like they show in the Masoretic text. And Nimrod's line corresponds with this, Table 4. By the time of the 10th generation, Terah, the average age of a father at the birth of a son, might be 70 years by Terah's time. And a lifespan 200 years. But the thing is, there's no way of explaining anything if... Let's see now. Well, that's right, yeah. They have such short time periods in some chronologies that that they can't explain how the population multiplied so fast, you know, with the time periods that they are allowing for these things to have happened. Like some people have the deluge happening at 2300 BC, where we have it at 3282 BC. If the deluge happened at 2300, how do you get Old Kingdom Egypt? There isn't such a thing then, because there's no time for it to have happened. No matter how short the generations were after the deluge, it still takes centuries to get any number of people. And we had 500 years passing after the deluge until the time of the Tower of Babel, right? And of course, at that time, we don't know exactly how many people there were, but, you know, every 100 years that passes is a lot more time. Since women can have children starting at the age of maybe, back in those days, we don't know. We don't know how old they were when they had their, when women first began to be able to bear children. What was their age? Could have been, if they were living 10 times what we live in terms of life, would it mean that women wouldn't be able to have children until they were 10 times as old? I mean, none of that really is known, I don't think. But by the time of Abraham, it was unheard of that a woman would have a child at the age of 90, according to the Bible, because Abraham was surprised that Sarah was going to have a child at the age of 90, according to what God had told him, what he was told by the angel that came and told him this, that, you know, that he was going to have a son. Sarah would have a child at the age of 90 and Abraham would be 100 at the time of the birth of his son Isaac, which is what happened. So 90 was old for a woman to have a child. That was Abraham's time, though. Abraham's time was 2200 BC, you see, which was not immediately following the deluge, not in our chronology. So they'd had time for the lifetimes to become shorter. Abraham lived 175 years, I believe, so. But that's still a long life for a man to live, and it suggests that maybe it's just, well, we don't know. Perhaps there are some, it's never been demonstrated that the Bible's ever been inaccurate in any way, right? But we just don't, we can't say that that means it's never inaccurate. Even if it's, we know there are things in the Bible that have to be corrected. That's we've already found some discrepancies in some of the genealogies and things like that. It's not perfect. The Bible isn't perfect, I don't think. So if it says that, we can't rely on it making one statement about how old Sarah was when she had a child. We don't know that this is reliable, we shouldn't base everything on this one scripture about Sarah being 90. And having a child, which is, we think that's true, that she had a child, but we shouldn't base an opinion that Abraham had about how old Sarah was. Maybe that's been embellished, where Abraham said, well, how could she have a child at the age of 90? That seemed, or even Sarah, according to the account, was incredulous about that. She didn't believe she was going to have a child. But that doesn't mean that we can turn that around and say, well, therefore they must have had children at the same age that everyone else does nowadays. We don't really know that. You can't, it doesn't work in that, in reverse like that. You can't reverse the logic like that. But anyway, by the time of Abraham, they still lived a long life, but not as long as they were living just after the deluge, immediately following the deluge. So, I mean, how long would it take a woman to have, I think that's why we use the estimate of 30 years per generation for a woman, to that she might need to be 30 years old before she could have a child. That's why we use that number 30, because we don't know. She might not have reached puberty as early back in those times because of the fact they lived longer in total. So it made sense to say that instead of at 13 years old, which might be the age at which a woman could have a child in the modern times, although it's not recommended necessarily, but that might be the earliest time, 12 or 13 or something like that, or even younger maybe, but if we multiply that by 3, we get about 30 years old, right? For the age of a woman back in those days, maybe the generation of a woman is 30 years, so after, you know, she can have so many children, each of those can have so many children, so every 30 years, there's another generation, essentially a whole family produced after every 30 years, is the idea, no matter how old the husband is. But we're really, you know, lacking a lot of information or detail. We lack a lot of the details. But we want it to make logical sense, and we want it to be reasonable. That's the thing. So we're trying to work it out. But this is, all of this part seems very relatively unknown. That's the end of our study for today. From chapter 4, paragraph 3 of the Ark of Urartu. So that gives me a little bit of time to talk about the battery. Not much time to talk about it. But the thing is, when you charge a battery, and it's a good, when you charge a good battery, the charging current will go down as it gets charged up. The charging current, I mean, if you charge at a constant voltage, like I was charging using a float voltage, which is just a trickle charge, but I'm using a power supply that can regulate the voltage and keeps it so it doesn't exceed, it cannot be greater than 13.2 volts. And the current is also, by the power supply, prevented from exceeding 1 amp. So I'm preventing it. I'm trickle charging it. But the current can drop. The voltage is maintained at 13.2 as much as possible, and the current can drop. But the voltage is also limited to 13.2. It can't go higher. It's actually set at 13.2. It's just set at 13.2. Unless there's so much current flow that, you know, that it drags the voltage down, which can't happen because there's only 1 amp allowed when I set the limit on the power supply. So the power supply, it's just a power supply, but it has a up to 5 amps, but I'm limiting it at 2 amp. I'm limiting it at, in this case, 1 amp. But, I mean, I could limit it at any other number between 1 and 5 or, any, you know, anything between 0 and 5 amps. But I was limiting it. I never went even, I was above 1 amp at one point, but I limited it to 1 amp for this last part of the charging at 13.2, which is a float voltage. So you can charge these batteries at a float voltage. And anyway, we're out of time. I'll talk about it more tomorrow. But the battery worked. It seems to be fully charged. Everything is good. October 12th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 18:16 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. My car works, too. I'm Word Green. I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now. I tested a lot of things today, a few things, enough.